so the natural alternatives are next week or the week after. So.
How far?
What's that?
How far? Like, do we have much left to cover in the grand scheme of?
It depends on, you know, we've been skipping things quite a lot, so it's a question of how much to skip. So today we'll probably do neutrinos, and then tomorrow would be things like, you know, whatever we decide to do in the last chapter. That's all the band and all the stuff.
So you have like supersymmetry and unified theory and GUTs and all this other stuff, right?
Yeah, so it's like we don't have to do it all, but that's kind of all. And I think doing those test chapters is great. So that's what the question really is how much of that stuff do you want to do? So think about it.
Just for the last class.
That's today. All right. So for neutrinos, okay, before we did the masses, you know, there's a lot of things about neutrinos that. So the neutrino, what's interesting with neutrino mass is that this is the first serious evidence that the standard model needs extending. And the basic statement is that oscillations have been seen. So in processes you have before you talk about oscillations, you have to say, so how do you manage the neutrinos? Neutrinos, if 10 billion neutrinos go through every square centimeter per second from the sun, and you don't see them, and they go through light years of light without interacting, how do you do any experiments at all with neutrinos, let alone oscillation experiments? And the way you do them is you take advantage of the fact that neutrinos are produced, you know, so essentially every time a pion decays, it decays to, pi plus or minus decays to a mean plus or minus, for neutrinos. He said lying to you. Neutrino. And so this happens essentially 100% of the time. You know, there's just trace amounts that decays to electrons for reasons that we talked about before. So every time a pion decays, you get a neutrino for free. And so the idea is that you can produce pions in strong interactions, you know, really easily. You collide protons into nuclei, and you get pions coming out your ears, then you just let those things decay. And so then your beam of pions and other things becomes a beam of muons and neutrinos, and you put some big object in front of it, like a pile of concrete, and it stops everything but the neutrinos. The neutrinos go through, and you get a neutrino beam that way. So you produce these neutrinos, but you always produce them in association with a charged lepton. And so this is one way of doing it. You could produce the neutrinos in a reactor where the electron is associated with a nuclear transition where you're emitting or absorbing an electron. And the oscillations are all about now, so you've got a process where in some way, in this case, say you've got a pion which decays to a muon and a neutrino. And you stop the muon by putting a bunch of concrete here. The neutrino goes right through. But the neutrino was, say, produced in association with the muon. So if you wanted to, you could watch over here the charged particle that's being produced with the invisible neutrino that you don't see. And then you have your detector over here, which is some big tank full of water, let's say, or it could be something else. And the neutrino undergoes an interaction. And there's two options. Either the neutrino, when the neutrino interacts with the particle, it could do that by exchanging a Z boson, in which case the neutrino stays a neutrino. And so you'd see some sort of a recoil here, and you don't see what it's recoiling against. That would be a neutral current interaction. But the neutrino could come in, and it could exchange a W, and then turn into a lepton, electron, or a muon, or a tau. And then you could see the lepton here. Something else might be coil over here. But, so the statement until the mid-1900s was, the mid-1990s was that whenever you had a reaction over here which involved the production of a muon, then the reaction that you detected was over here, if you had a charged particle, it was always a muon that appeared. You never would produce something with a muon and have it be detected with an electron, or it's never produced with an electron and have it detected with a muon. It was always the same flavor, and that was what led to the statement that lepton number flavor, lepton flavor muonness, electronness, and tauness was separately conserved, and the muons and the charged leptons separately carried them. And what's happening in the oscillation experiments is that you're seeing processes now where one kind of lepton is appearing here, and a different kind is appearing here. And so the simplest one is for solar neutrinos, you know, you've got the sun. And so there's various nuclear reactions taking place in here, which involve basically reactions involving electrons. So you're converting, in the end of the day, you're converting protons. You know, you're taking four protons, and you're, in the end of the day, getting helium, which is two protons and two neutrons. And so two of these protons, in the end of the day, became neutrons. And so the electric charge had to come out as a positron, and then there's neutrinos involved. So you've got a process here involving electrons. So let me just draw something where you have electrons, positrons, and a neutrino. And you sit over here on the Earth with your tank of water, and you detect the neutrinos, and you look for them in a way which, in the end of the day, you're looking for them in a way which, if you detect them with a charge current interaction, you're looking to see did you have them produced with an electron or not. And mostly all the detectors until very recently had detection processes which involved seeing of this electron. And the basic problem with solar neutrinos was that the flux of these neutrinos that you were getting, you can at some level predict, given that you know how brightly the sun shines, you know how often this reaction is happening. And you're detecting, at the time, they're detecting, you know, factors of 2 to 3, or factors of 2, really too small. And how many fewer you got than you expected depended a little bit on how you detected them. And that's because there's various reactions that emit neutrinos here. They have different energies, and the different ways of measuring the neutrinos were sensitive to different energies. If you look at the, you know, if here you're looking at the scattering of neutrinos with chlorine giving you argon, I guess plus stuff which I don't care. That was one way people look for solar neutrinos. What they did is they had a big tank of cleaning fluid which had a lot of chlorine in it, and every month or so they'd flush it and they'd count the argon atoms, and there'd be 3 if they'd find them. And so they would know how many neutrinos had interacted. The other way of doing it would be that you take water and you look for, you know, so you get water with electrons on it, and the neutrinos can scatter from the electrons, and you end up see the electron moving through the water. Or you can see, you know, like in the assignment, the neutrinos reacting with the nuclei. You can, but you typically don't. So let's focus on this. But the bottom line is that to see this electron, it has to have a minimum energy. And so there's a minimum energy neutrino that you could see in this way. And it happens that if you look at the spectrum of solar neutrinos, there's a whole bunch of neutrinos that come up at low energies. And then there's a line with some medium energies. This would be, an MeV. And then there's a fairly broad boron neutrino spectrum, which kind of goes out, you know, to higher energies. And the threshold for these kind of detections is something up here at say 6 to 8 MeV. So they're only really seeing neutrinos from this that are very energetic and from this one channel. The neutrinos you can see in this reaction are kind of down here. You can see these guys and these guys. But most of the neutrinos that are, so I drew this like the same amount, there's actually by far most of it, and this is a log scale, so that you're getting something like 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 neutrinos per square centimeter per second down here. Up here, you're getting something like 10 to the 6th or something. There's a lot fewer of these neutrinos. And these are the ones that are sensitive to the basic reaction that's powering the sun. So these are the ones whose abundance you really know sensitive there is tied to the luminosity of the sun. And so by comparing different experiments, you can kind of compare, you have some handle on different kinds of neutrinos that are being produced and whether they're suppressed or not in what you see. Eventually, a reaction like this was developed where you take gallium and produce germanium, and it has a very low threshold, and it actually allows you to see these neutrinos. And by comparing these three classes of experiments, you get some sort of a sense of the energy dependence of the suppression. And what happened was essentially that the pattern is that there's about half of these are seen. It's consistent with seeing essentially none of these. And these ones are not suppressed at all, basically, is what you find when you put all the experiments together.
Did you say that those two distributions were?
Which ones?
Did you,
these ones here?
Yeah.
This is there's a whole bunch of reactions. If you actually take the reaction cycle here in the sun, there's a bunch of the nuclear reactions. And at three or four places, they're emitting neutrinos. So if you look at the spectrum of neutrinos coming from the sun, it's typically some thermal thing. But each of the reactants gives you a different distribution. And so this is superposing them. And so the most abundant, most of the energy comes from this PP, because you start off with protons, finding protons, but then the protons start, you've originally protoned with a proton form, say deuterium or something, and you kind of work your way up to get helium in steps. And so what happens is that if you look at the reaction chain, they start off doing the same things, and then there's a branch, and there's two possible sets of reactions that can happen. And most of the energy is associated with the ones involving the PP neutrinos that everybody does, and then those are the most abundant ones, and those are the ones that are really getting this flux wrong would be basically hard to do, given that you know how many reactions are happening, given you know the luminosity of the sun. But the ones that these other experiments are sensitive to are typically not those, because their detectors only go down to some energy, and so because otherwise the backgrounds get to be too large. So they're seeing reactions that are kind of these are boron neutrinos, and I can't remember exactly what the reaction is, but it's one of the reactions that's kind of a long one chain late in the day. You've got a reaction where your boron is being produced, or light is being produced, and the neutrino being emitted there is particularly high energy compared to the other ones. And those are the only ones that say SNOW sees, and super K. All the water detectors only see those because they can't get down to low enough energy to see the other ones. This line here is there's a monoenergetic, I'm doing this on top of my head now. It seems like these are the PEP neutrinos, that there's a, basically the statement is that it's like a decay, if you have a two-body decay, then the particles come out with a specific energy. If you have a three-body decay, then you get a continuous distribution. And beta decays tend to be three-body things, and that's kind of why you see continuous distributions. So there's a line here because the reaction you're looking at is the kinematics is such that it's essentially a two-body decay, and I can't remember what the reaction exactly was. And so there's a fairly sharp feature there in the spectrum, which is kind of between the threshold here and the threshold for this reaction. So you kind of have you basically have three windows of energies that the reactions can see, and there's three kinds of reactions that are there to be seen, which are different. So there's a very low energy ones to see everybody. These guys just see these two kinds of reactions, and these guys just see this one.
How many events are we talking about
when
we have these big
tanks going up? What's the? Oh, not very many at all. It's for these guys, I remember it's really like a handful per month or for every few months they find five atoms. It's not really phenomenal thing like that.
How do they know that's not just?
Well, that's why it took them 20 years to convince anybody that there's something wrong. Because this is the first one that was done, and So yeah, you know, everybody said, well, yeah, so you mentioned that, okay. So then, and then also, you know, who's to know the sun is gonna, you did the sun wrong, because you're really only seeing, because this is an energetic reaction, it's, you're living off the tail of the Boltzmann distribution. So you change the temperature to the core of the sun just by a little bit, and the tail changes dramatically, and this reaction completely changes a lot. So the reaction rate for this particular neutrino goes like the temperature at the center of the sun to some very large power. I can't remember what it is now, but it's like 10 or 18 or something. And so people say, well, you just lower the temperature of the sun by just a small bit, and you're going to make that reaction whatever you like. But then as people, so then other experiments also saw the suppression. And then you got a better handle on the temperature of the sun, the core of the sun, because people can measure helioseismic waves. And so you can really see the sun is pulsating. And so that's telling you about the sound waves in the sun right down the core. And that's constraining what the temperature could be in the core. And you don't have a lot of freedom to change the temperature by a lot there. And you know, say in these kind of detectors, you say you missed some atoms. So then what they did is they had to do this in France, because nowhere else could you do this. They got some really enormously radioactive source, and they stuck it next to the detector. And so then they have a known source, and so then they could calibrate it that way. So they did things like that, but it took a long time to do it because people had all these beliefs. And for snow and super K, I can't remember what the reaction rate is, but it's we could figure it out. Actually, it'd be a good exercise. Because you know that these things are basically, the flux of these things is something like 10 to the 6 per square centimeter per second. So you're getting a lot of them, but then the weak interaction cross-section, you can figure it out, but it's extremely small. So then you can estimate if someone gives you a ton of water, how many reactions you get, and it's not very large at all. So the only way that they could actually do it, because they have to pick it out of the background, so there's other reactions that are going on. So what the way that they actually saw this with super K first was, they're not so deep as snow is. So what they did is they can see the direction of the angle of the electron because they're seeing a Cherenkov film. And so what they did is they plotted the number of these electrons they saw as a function of the angle away from the sun. And if you do that, there's kind of it peaks away from the sun. And so you can tell that the ones in the peak are coming from the sun, whereas the ones that are not in the peak are just actually coming from other events, where the main ones are diverting from rockets. So they had new tricks like that to kind of see these things at all. And so this might be wrong, but what I remember was that, 10 years ago, people saying that if you took all the swarm things ever been seen in any of these detectors and you added them all up, you had something like 100 or something in that ballpark. It wasn't really a bunch of, actually the total number of events was quite small. That might be wrong, it might be 1,000, it might be. Probably changed a lot since snow came along, but it's not impressive compared to what you expect in other detectors. So the main message is that so snow was particularly good because in deuterium you have several ways to you see the even in ordinary water you have some sensitivity to muon and tau neutrinos because they can scatter elastically with electrons through Z exchange. But in deuterium you have also the process where you can dissociate the deuterium with elastic scattering like that. And so you can directly detect the muon and the tau neutrinos more efficiently because you're scattering, they can even see them in the nuclear cross sections. And as you saw in the exercise, the nuclear cross sections tend to be higher than the cross sections with electrons. So having deuterium, having heavy water in the detector for snow was actually a huge advantage because it allowed them to separately measure the flux of electron neutrinos, what that really is the flux of reactants involving electrons in their detection from the total flux of all three neutrinos in the standard model. And the bottom line was that they found that if you summed up the contribution of all the neutrinos, mu, tau, electron, you got what you expected from the sun. And if you only looked at the electron neutrinos, you got what everyone else was getting. And so that the difference really seems to be in the mu. It's consistent with the difference being the mu and the tau neutrino. So there is reactions that are happening where they're all being produced with electrons only because they're being produced in this nuclear physics reaction, but they're being detected where you can have essentially electron muons and taus here. And so this basic process is happening where the electrons that are associated with production and the detection are different. And since then, people have taken the same detector, like Super K, and they've shone a neutrino beam into it. And so there's now a terrestrial source that you can kind of see evidence of the same kind of thing happening with less significance, but still statistically significant oscillations. But it's not as there's fewer events happening than the ones from the sun because there's just fewer neutrinos arriving. So that's one of the classes of evidence for neutrino oscillations. The second main class is coming from atmospheric neutrinos. For atmospheric neutrinos, so what happens there is, so here we are on the Earth, and here's the atmosphere. And we're being bombarded with cosmic rays all the time, which are basically protons. And so that if a cosmic ray comes and hits the atmosphere, the proton hits a nitrogen nucleus and produces junk. And the junk involves a lot of pions. And then each pion, so you have that closing increase of pi plus decays all the time pretty much to a mu plus and what would have been a muon neutrino. And then the muon decays essentially all the time to an E plus, and then electron neutrino, and then muon and neutrino. So if you sit at the bottom of a pion beam, if you did a pi minus, it would have just been a mu minus and an N neutrino, and a E minus and an N neutrino and a neutrino. But the bottom line is that you're expecting, at the bottom of this stuff, you get a whole bunch of crap that comes out here. But then, if we include neutrinos, neutrinos just keep on going. But you're expecting a 2-to-1 ratio from muon to electron neutrinos for every pion that's being produced. So you expect two new mu's and anti new mu's for each new E, basically. And what they found, you have your tank here again, and you watch these things come in. And the beautiful thing about these things is that the cosmic ray could have been over here, and then the neutrino goes through, hits a rock here, and becomes a muon, and you see the muon coming up. So you can really see these things from all directions, and you can compare the flux from below and the flux from above. And what they found is that it's one new mu for each new E. And of course, it's the usual thing. So people say, "Well, yeah, so that's what you say," but you do a sophisticated Monte Carlo to do better than 2-to-1 here, and you find that it's not exactly 2-to-1; it's 2.1 per 1. And then you say, "Well, your Monte Carlo is not good enough. You've screwed that up." So it's really some atmospheric effect which makes it 1-to-1. So nobody was really so convinced for 10, 15 years until they finally, what convinced people the most was that they were able to find an asymmetry. If you just compared the upward going ones to the downward going ones, it was different. And there's very few things that can make an asymmetry up versus down in the atmosphere. The Earth's magnetic field was the closest thing you'd get, which would distinguish an up versus down because it might affect how the cosmic rays come in. But you could never get a 2-for-1 effect that way. And so once they had a statistically significant asymmetry up versus down, it didn't depend anymore on the details of the Monte Carlo and what happened in the atmosphere. And that really made it that much more convincing that there was something there that was funny. So these things kind of tripped along for 20 years where they were annoying experimental anomalies, but it wasn't really ultra convincing that it was seeing neutrino physics as opposed to something else. And again, in this kind of a process, they've tried to confirm it by setting up a terrestrial source of neutrinos, and it also seems to see the same thing. So the bottom line is that there's good evidence that the neutrinos are turning into the flavor is not conserved. Individual electron, muon, and tau flavor are not conserved for the lepton sector.
Why did it go to one?
Well, the picture is that what's happening is that the muon neutrinos are oscillating into electron neutrinos.
But do they actually give you a one-to-one ratio or not? Just like
roughly what it was, not exactly what it was. So what?
I didn't think that they would also eat that much of it.
Oh, there's an interesting thing that happens. So far we talked about oscillations as if they're happening in the vacuum, but there's a mechanism where as the neutrinos pass through matter, they can very efficiently oscillate, much more efficiently than they would have done in the vacuum. And that's actually what happens in this. So I should actually say more about the solar neutrinos maybe to show you what's happening there. And what's happening is that, at least in this case, the thing is coming through the Earth, the same thing's happening. As they pass through the Earth, there's a resonant oscillation going on that's making it more efficient than it would have otherwise been. So that for resonant oscillation, what's happening is that this is sometimes called MSW oscillations from Mikhaev, Smirnov, and Wolfenstein. And the idea is that for vacuum oscillations, what's happening is you have when I do this after I do the kinematic neutrino masses. And then once you see how an oscillation works without the matter, then it's easier to see what happens when you have the matter. So one night I'll pause on this and come back to it. But remind me to do it if I don't. So what would it take to get neutrino oscillations? The idea is that this is very much like what we did for the neutral, the K's and the B mesons last time, that if electron number and muon number are not conserved separately, then there's nothing which distinguishes these neutrinos from one another. There's no exactly conserved quantum number which distinguishes them. And so people talk about it as if you produce an electron neutrino and then it turns into a muon neutrino. But really, if you think of propagation, you should always diagonalize the kinetic terms with mass terms. And if you do that in the standard model, you know that if you had a mass which mixed up the different flavors of neutrinos, like we did for the quarks, when we originally started off with quark masses, we had the Yukawa interactions between the Higgs and the quarks was not flavor diagonal, and we had to diagonalize it. When we did that, we picked up the Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix in the interactions with the W bosons. So thought of in terms of mass eigenstates, what happens with the quarks is that you have the processes where the flavor of quark changes as you could say the same thing for quarks as we do for leptons. And if a neutrino is like an up type quark for leptons, and the electron is like a down type quark. So if you look at a reaction where you let an up type quark travel between just production and detection, and you ask what was the associated down type quark that was being produced when it was being, the up type quark was produced or when it was being detected, the same story would go through. And we wouldn't be surprised to find that you can produce a down quark, say, associated with an up quark when it was produced, but with a charm quark or something, or charm quark when it's decaying or when it's being detected. And that would just mean that that's just because we know that the KM matrix says that there's always some amplitude for each up quark being associated with each possible down quark when it emits a W boson. In terms of the propagation eigenstates, it just means that you have more than one kind of interaction that could take place with a W boson. You have an up type quark with a down type quark, an up type quark with a strange type quark, an up type quark with a bottom type quark. And for neutrinos, that's an equivalent way of thinking about it too. You should think about it in terms of oscillations as kind of a quaint way of thinking about it. Really what you should think about is that you've got three kinds of neutrinos, and the basic charge current interaction with the W has the form of, there's a W mu, lepton, say bar, gamma mu, gamma left, and then you have all three neutrinos could be here with some matrix, D, neutrino, or I guess L neutrino. So this is the analog of the Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix. And so these guys are mass eigenstates I'm thinking about. And the charge current interactions look like what they would have done for the quarks. And what that would describe exactly what you're seeing here if you could arrange for something like this to happen. So the kind of thing that you're looking for to describe oscillations is really, if somebody were to hand you a mass term for neutrinos, then it would be very easy to generate something like this where you diagonalize the masses and you find that the charge pair interactions aren't diagonal anymore, just like they were for quarks. And so it seems like it's the easiest possible thing in the world to try and get, describe these kind of interactions. And it works. If you can get a mass term, this whole process of getting oscillations would go through just like for the quark sector. So the whole issue is, how do you get a mass term for the neutrinos? And why didn't we get one for the neutrinos when we got one for quarks? The reason we didn't was that we didn't have the, you know, for quarks we had, well, let me write something down here. So if there were a mass term for the neutrinos, if it mixed flavors, neutrino flavors, it would induce a CKM-like matrix in the charge current sector, in the charge current direction of leptons. And this CKM matrix is called a PMS matrix, I think. So it's not the PMS matrix, but it's close. And the number of letters in that list gets longer as it gets more and more likely to be true when everyone wants to have some glory. So it's, I forgot who all the people are here, but P is a quantum correlate. We kind of, decades before everyone else was thinking about these things. So the trick is, where do you get a matrix? Where do you get a mass term? And so for quarks, we had, a doublet of left-handed guys, and then we had a right-handed quark and a right-handed up and down quark separately. But for leptons, in the standard model, the difference was we had the doublet again. We had the neutrino and the electron, but then we only had a right-handed electron. We didn't have a right over here, I guess. We didn't have a right-handed neutrino. But nothing stops us from having a right-handed neutrino. So one way we could proceed. So what if there were a right-handed neutrino? Like for the lectin, for the electrons. This is one of the assignments, you know. So you know what the properties of this thing would have to be, because what we're asking is we want this to be whatever it has to be to give us the appropriate mass term, right? So N has quantum numbers such that you can write down a term like L N Higgs. And so since we know the quantum numbers of the doublet and the Higgs, we can read off what the quantum numbers of the right-handed neutrino are. And the interesting thing is that it has to be a singlet under everything. It requires N to be under, so if I ask how it behaves under SC3, across SC2, across SC1. If it's a singlet under SC3, doesn't take part of color, because the doublet and the Higgs don't. It's a singlet under SC2, because the doublet and Higgs can make the SC2 in a transformation be invariant. And it's got to be neutral under U1, because the doublet and the Higgs cancel. So I probably got that, that's right, yeah. So this is something which is something like that is called sterile. It doesn't interact with any of the gauge interactions at all. You know, if you thought neutrinos were weakly interacting, then this is really weakly interacting, because neutrinos actually take part in the weak interactions. This doesn't take part in any of the weak interactions. The only way you need to know about them is that they're mixing with the ordinary neutrinos in a mass term, so that they're they're going to show up in reactions only in as much as they mix with the ordinary neutrinos. So that's actually encouraging, because if you imagine these things to be around, it would be easy to have missed them so far experimentally. So they're easy to miss. On the other hand, there's, you know, the evidence for neutrino masses. What you have to worry about a little bit is that, if the basic interaction involves neutrinos that are sterile here, if you can have a process like this where you produce a neutrino which is sterile from some reaction, like in the sun, say, then if it's sterile, you're not going to detect it. It's just going to disappear. And the fact that in solar neutrinos, when they add up the contribution of all three kinds of neutrinos and they compare it to what's expected from the sun, and they get something which agrees, that limits how many times you could get neutrinos which are just appearing. You know, what we're doing here by adding sterile neutrinos is saying that there's more neutrinos than just these three, and they are even harder to detect than ordinary neutrinos are. And we can't do that with impunity, because we know that if you add up the three that we see, we get something which is consistent with what we expected to be produced. And so there are constraints on how much these kind of neutrinos can actually appear in reactions like this, given that you can actually count with all three neutrinos in things like snow. It's also true that if you have stars that are producing neutrinos, say any channel that produces sterile neutrinos gives you a very efficient energy loss mechanism, because they can just produce these things and then those things are gone. Also, their existence is constrained from things like the snow measurements of solar neutrino. So energy loss. Supernovas and astrophysics. Now, how efficient these things are depends on the masses of these neutrinos and exactly the details of the masses that we can write down here. So what I'm not saying is that you can't make them in neutrino masses this way. You can, but there's, depending on how you do it, you could run into constraints. So you remember from when you did this in the assignment that so if these things existed, if a bunch of neutrinos existed, we have to add the most general normalizable thing is the standard model plus new things involving these m's. So you have kinetic terms for the m's. There's it's minus mri d slash. So we have an arbitrary mass matrix for these guys. There's nothing which constrains this mass matrix, because these things carry no gauge symmetries at all, so the gauge symmetries can't restrict it right down there. And then we have also these Yukawa couplings, so we'll say y I a times L bar a gamma left. And I think something like that. So you've got masses which mix these guys with each other, and you've got masses which are to do with the mixing of these guys with the ordinary neutrinos once we replace the Higgs with the excitation guy. So if H is 0V, this is going to become a mass between, you know, neutrino A, gamma left, and I. Times V. So this, in the end of the day, the mass matrix, you know, let's say we have, you know, we have no idea how many of these things we can write down. We could write down one, the natural thing would be to write down three, because we have three families of other things, the one that went down 3, but you could write down 65 at least, if you like, because we know nothing about how many of them there are. And the mass matrix in general, so the left-handed mass matrix, so. It's going to be something of the form, if I write, you know, psi, it starts off with three neutrinos, so nu e, nu mu, nu tau, and then n1, n2, all the way down to whatever they start off with. And the general mass term we're going to get is going to be minus 1/2 psi bar gamma left. J, where I and J are going to run down that list, times some mass matrix M on J, plus the complex conjugate. That's the most general mass term we could possibly have. And we know we can always diagonalize this mass matrix to write it in terms of mass eigenstates. And when we do that, what will happen is that all the charge current interactions, the W boson couple to these guys, don't, but not to these guys. And when we do this diagonalization, we're going to end up mixing these things up. So this matrix we're looking at here is a symmetric matrix. And if you kind of focus on the E, mu, tau sector, and then the, you know, the steroidal sector, then this thing here, M, would be the thing that appears down here. This is zero, because there's no term here which involves two L's. And this off-diagonal thing is the thing that's being controlled by this thing here. So there's a Y times a B. So we have Y. Let's say this is A equals E of tau. Y, A, J, B, which would be Y. B equals so there's an important difference between these entries and these entries, and that's that you know, V here, we know already, is 246 GeV. We don't know how big the Ys are, but if we're believing perturbation theory, which we are, if we're using, if we're just calling this a mass term, then we're thinking that these Ys, YAI should be, you know, less than 1. If they were of order 1, then we'd be having entries here which are of the order of hundreds of GeV. This is some random thing. You know, God only knows what this is. But you can kind of see that if this were 0, you're going to have masses which are of the order of this size, hundreds of GeV. If this is enormous, then what will happen is that these guys are going to be very light, these guys are going to be very heavy, but they'll mix with each other a little bit. And if they're all the same size, then they're all the same size. So given that the neutrinos are very light, the simplest picture would be if this is actually enormous. Because first of all, there's nothing which makes it small. These things were forced to be small because they're proportional to V. And that was because these kinds of masses involving one of these guys and one of these guys is forbidden by SU2 Perrossi 1 invariance. That's why you need the Higgs here. It's only allowed because you spontaneously break the SU2 Perrossi 1 invariance. So its upper bound in size is the size of SU2 Perrossi 1 breaking. So that's why that's restricted. But these masses here are coming from this. There's no symmetry in the problem at all, which makes them anything. They should be the basic mass in your problem. Now we know, besides the standard model, there's other scales in the problem. We know that, you know, in particular, the Planck mass is a scale that's out there. You know, it would be very natural for this number to be the Planck mass. It could be any number that you think of any scale of physics that's out there. There's no reason why this should be particularly small. So it's actually not such a stretch to imagine that this is actually bigger than the weak interaction scales. And so that's a particularly interesting limit to think about in this matrix, because it predicts, in that limit where this is bigger than these guys, there's a simple thing to say, there's a simple statement about what the masses are, what the mass eigenvalues are. So if the entries in M, J, are much bigger than YAIV, And so we're not going to allow any zeros in this matrix, since there's no zero eigenvalues or anything in this matrix. Then you can expand the eigenstates perturbatively in Y over M. Then the eigenvalues of the whole thing, let's call this thing capital M with the line up, so you can distinguish this thing from that M. Of M. I'm in two types. So there's, let's say that there were n of these sterile neutrinos. So you're going to get n states of mass, which are of order capital M. And you're going to get three states. In the limit that that this is zero compared to this, then it's actually easy to see what the eigenstates are. There's going to be three massless states, and there's going to be n massive states. But when these things are turned on, all those masses are going to get perturbed. You don't care about the perturbation of these ones much because they're huge masses anyway. But these ones that were zero get perturbed away from zero by an amount which has got to go to zero when YV goes to zero. And it turns out that the mass is basically it's order YV squared divided by M. More explicitly, it's the eigenvalues of you take the matrix Y A V A I M inverse I J. So this is the inverse matrix of M, not the inverse of M I J. That's Y B, J, M, B. That matrix, little m, A, B, is that the 3x3 matrix? If you took that as the mass matrix, to lowest order in Y over M, this is the mass matrix which is describing these light masses. So that's a very attractive picture, right? Because the generic situation you'd expect is that you're expecting this is actually not going to be small because there's no reason for it to be small. And it appears as a positive mass in the Lagrangian, so it's not like it's a term in the Lagrangian which should be suppressed by masses. The biggest mass should win there. So you expect this to be as big as it can be. These ones are fixed to be, they have to be less than the weak scale, but there's no reason why they should be. The masses, I didn't say this, but that. The masses that you're looking at here, so the experiments point to which are less than or in the order of, say, 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. What they really see are mass differences in a way I'll get to more explicitly, but we're looking at very, very small masses. So if this had been zero, and you're trying to get those masses from this kind of a mass matrix with the Ys, because Ys would have to be extremely small. So you need 10 to the minus 11 or something for Y to get the mass to be small enough. But for garden variety Ys, as big as the other Yukawa couplings we know about, given that M should be very large anyway, there's no reason why it shouldn't be large. There's a very attractive picture here where if M is large, you would expect the lightest states that are mostly E, mu, and tau to have a small non-zero mass. That would be something of the order of this. And its smallness is not because the Ys are small, it's because M is large compared to the scale V. And so these are naturally very light. You know, in particular, if Y squared V squared over M is on the order of, you know, let's say it's 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. And if Y is, let's say that's order 1, just to make it easy. Since V is something like 10 to 10 squared GeV, which is 10 to the 11th electron volts. And you can see that M has to be of the order of 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. It's in the plus step. I feel to do math here. That sucks. So it's of the order of V squared divided by 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. So that's 10 to the 22, 10 to the 24 electron volts, which is something like 10 to the 15 GeV, right? So that's a healthy big mass. That's not so much smaller than the Planck mass. If we made y non-zero, let's say we didn't keep this, then we just have to keep y squared here. So if you want y to be 10 to the minus 1, then you're at 10 to the 13 GeV. This whole thing would work if there was a big scale up there where these neutrinos got masses. That would explain why you didn't see all those sterile neutrinos, because they're so heavy that you can't see them. It would also explain why the ones you see are very light. And the mixing angles between the light ones and the heavy ones are going to be of the order of YV divided by M, which are going to be very small. And that's something which is going to like to be consistent with these experiments, because there's not a large admixture between the light neutrinos and the heavy neutrinos. So that's a very compelling picture. That whole mechanism, this kind of mechanism for making things light, is called the seesaw mechanism. Because a seesaw, I don't know if you guys still use that word, but seesaw is the thing you sit on. You go up and down. A person sits here, a person sits here. And the idea is that as one gets more and more massive, the other one gets more and more light. So that's the... So that's a very, very plausible change to the standard model, which would fit the picture of neutrino masses in a very plausible way. What's happening at that scale M? There is something happening there, because even though that's the scale at which you're starting to violate the lepton number, and so the picture would be that there's something going on at that scale. In this particular case, it's the existence of these sterile neutrinos and the existence of that explicit mass for them, which is breaking lepton number. But it's this is an example of how lepton number breaking at a large scale could produce neutrinos that are very light. So the bottom line for that is very plausible extension. And it's kind of a minimal extension, too. So it breaks lepton number at a high scale. In this case, M of the order of 10 to the, say, 15, or 10 to the y squared concentric in GeV. And by small neutrino masses and enormous sterile neutrino masses, and those are both things that we like. Order y squared v squared over m, and these are order m. Now that's a special case of a more general statement. So, you know, if these things are really so heavy, then, you know, the whole story of the standard model has been that the standard model is the most general thing that you can have, which is consistent with being renormalizable. And being renormalizable means that the thing that you didn't look at that was heavier than the standard model was so heavy that you could neglect terms of order 1 over m. And all those terms that were order 1 over m, if you didn't want to neglect them, were there to be seen in the non-renormalizable interactions. So if this is the way things work, we should be able to capture all the physics that's here in terms of non-renormalizable interactions in the standard model, because what we're really saying here is that all these neutrinos are very heavy. So if all the m's are heavy, be integrated out. And their effects at low energies, and certainly in train physics, the way we understand it is being looked at in low energies. In this case, it's much less than M. Is described by the renormalizable part has to be the standard model, because that's the definition of the standard model. It's the most general renormalizable thing with the particle content we have, plus non-renormalizable interactions. So it's useful to think about what these interactions could be, because this model may not be right, but the features of this model that are attractive are that heavy things can give you a neutrino mass, because the neutrino masses are arising in order 1 over m. And 1 over m would naturally appear here if you had something that was not renormalizable. All these couplings in the non-renormalizable terms are suppressed by at least one power of a heavy mass. And that's what that smells like over there. So we should have an understanding of what's going on. It should be possible to describe that model over there in a more general way, which is not specific to that specific way of breaking lepton convert. And that and it's not restricted to neutrino masses. We should just we could ask the question more systematically. We could say, well, what are the possible non-renormalizable interactions? And let's write them all down. And maybe some of them will be neutrino interactions, and some of them will be neutrino masses, and some of them will be other things. We should look for everything, not just neutrino masses. And that will tell us something about what we can possibly hope to see from high energies. So the question is, what are possible non-renormalizable interactions? Wow. SU3 process 2 1. Because these must parameterize the effects of higher energy physics. So the must part has assumptions to it. The assumptions are, if no new particles are light, for example, if in this thing over here, supposing that this matrix M had a whole bunch of zeros, so you had a lot of zero eigenvectors, then that would mean that at low energies you'd have three neutrinos we know about, plus sterile neutrinos that are actually light. And those things could then be produced in experiments like the solar neutrino oscillations, and you could worry about seeing them. In that case, the low energy implications of these sterile guys is not going to be captured by some non-renormalizable interaction involving the light guys, because you've actually got new light guys, these new neutrinos that are sterile in your low energy theory. You didn't know they were there because they interacted so weakly, but they're there, and because they're light, they have to be kept in the low energy theory, and you won't capture them with some non-renormalizable interactions involving only the standard model fields. So that's why it was important to have no zeros there. It's also true that we're assuming that the standard model is everybody in the standard model is actually there at low energies, and the one that's up for grabs there is the Higgs particle. If the Higgs particle is not at low energies, then there's nothing that says that the standard model has to be the first term there. Then you're kind of in a more difficult situation where you don't have the Higgs particle. If this is not true, the second thing, then the theory has to break down not too much farther above the energies we have access to, well before you get up to 10 to the 15 GeV, because the whole consistency of the theory starts to fail if you don't have a Higgs particle. Something else has to be there to replace the Higgs particle before you get to more than a few TeV, a few thousand TeV. And that's why the LHC was invented, was to find whatever that is, the Higgs or its replacement. But subject to these two assumptions, what could you look at? What could you look for? Well, you can make lists. That's, what's nice about this is that you can make it to a list, and once you can make a list, you can be systematic. Then you can stop thinking and you just become an accountant. And so all you have to be is just diligent rather than clever in making these lists. So non-normalized interactions, you know, they're supposed to be the ones that have couplings which are inverse powers of mass. Right? And so you remember, this has mentioned the mass of the fourth, because the action, which is the integral d4x of that, is dimensionless, because that has dimensions of h bar and h bar is 1. So this has to have dimensions of mass of the fourth and units for h bar and c are 1. And so if I don't count the dimensions of the coupling constants, I just count the dimensions of the derivatives and the operators, then those things have to have dimensions at least mass to the fifth or higher to be non-normalizable, because their coefficients, then the coupling constants will then have to have dimensions of inverse mass to make the whole thing work. So if I write this as being sum over operators of some coefficients times some operator built out of the fields, you know, so we have L and E, Higgs field, Q, V, Gauge field, and so on. Then if this thing has dimension bigger than or equal to 5, let's say call it d sub I. Then this coefficient here has dimension which is 4 minus g, in order to make this whole thing have dimensions of mass of the fourth. So then I'm going to write this as, I guess, mass. So the first thing to do is to look at all the ones that have dimension 5. How many ways can we make things having dimensions of mass to the fifth out of the fields that are available to us? So the dominant coefficients will be dominant coefficients, right, of dimension 5. So those are the OIs for which Di is equal to 5. Then the first subdominant will be dimension 6, 6, and 7, 8, and so on. So the claim, which I can't remember if I gave you this as a homework problem or not, is you can make a list of the most general thing as dimension 5, and the answer is there's a unique interaction. So there is a unique dimension 5 interaction built from the standard model fields, only standard model fields, which is SU3 plus SU2 plus U1 VI. So what is that interaction? It's L5 would be some coefficient, which is, let me write it as something dimensionless. So let's say it's GAB divided by M, just to write the scale, the mass scale explicitly, times LA bar MLF LB. Now what were the quantum numbers of L? L, remember, was it's a doublet. And it's got to have a hypercharge the thing on the top is a neutrino that's neutral, so it has to have hypercharge of minus 1/2, right? That's the neutrino electron. The left-handed piece has those quantum numbers. So this thing is as it stands, it's this combination of two doublets, so that could be a triplet or a singlet. But it's got hypercharge minus one as the main thing. Whereas the Higgs, remember, was a phi plus phi zero. And so that had hypercharge plus 1/2. So you can kind of see that you can always make this work by having H here. But the SU2 indices are contracted in such a way to make it SU2 invariant. But the hypercharge is going to work, and the SU3 will work for free. And the claim is that this is all you can write down. And so the AB here is I'm keeping track of the flavor indices. I suppress the SU2 indices, but it's certainly true that I can make. The way to think about this is that this combination of Higgs is symmetric, so that the symmetric combination of two doublets is a triplet, and the anti-symmetric combination is a singlet. So this has to be the triplet combination, so you're asking for this thing to be a triplet combination to make the SU2 indices work. And if you replace the. So when H is 0V, so this is just the ground state in unitary gauge, then this is exactly what we've been talking about. This is something which would be GAB V squared over M times nu A bar MLF. I think plus complex quantity here. GAB. And that's exactly the kind of mass term. This is exactly the kind of thing that we would have gotten over here. If we had this explicit theory microscopically, then we could read off what the G's are. The G's are YAI, M inverse IJ, and YBJ. That's what this combination of G over M is. So G, if I call CAB the coefficient, which is GAB over M, that would have been YAI, M inverse IJ, YBJ in the sterile neutrino model. But you can get this, all you need here is something which this interaction violates LE, L mu, L tau, and L, which is LE plus L mu plus L tau. If these coefficients are non-zero, this thing necessarily violates total lepton number as well, because remember, lepton number is an axial transformation. These are all Majorana fields. So lepton number is an axial transformation, and this is not invariant under the rotation, under nu goes to, your intuition might have been that if I take nu goes to e to the I theta nu, then this will go to e to the minus I theta nu, and so the e to the I theta will cancel, and that's invariant. But for Majorana fields, and these are Majorana fields, because they came from the lepton doublet. The lepton symmetry is nu goes to e to the I theta gamma phi nu. Because the right-handed guys have to go the opposite way for the left-handed guys because they're Majorana. And that gamma phi means that both these things transform the same way. So any non-zero coefficient here breaks this. So as long as your physics at high energies that breaks your lepton numbers, LE, L mu, and L tau, also breaks L, no matter what that physics is, it doesn't have to be a sterile neutrino. It can give you an operator like this, and then the scale that will appear here, this scale will be the scale of lepton number breaking. If you ask, the smallest mass always wins in the denominator. You might ask, when I integrate out the W boson, why don't I get a term here with MW in the denominator? And that's because to contribute to that, you have to break lepton number. And the whole standard model didn't break lepton numbers. So if you integrate out stuff at the W scale, you'll never get a contribution because this thing has a selection role which is not respected by the standard model. If we'd asked for an interaction which was allowed by the standard model, you would get all kinds of things like the Fermi interaction, which is suppressed by a small mass. It's because this thing breaks lepton number that it's suppressed by a big scale, and the big scale could be the one that wins. Because at the smallest scale, it's consistent with the symmetries that you're breaking. So there's lots of models you can make, and the book gives you a second example just so you can know it's not unique of different models where you break lepton number, say in the Higgs sector, but when you integrate out physics, if it's heavy, you get that kind of interaction. So so the statement there would be that with these assumptions. There's no new particles around, and there's a Higgs particle, and the Higgs particle is light enough that you're supposed to classify operators by including the Higgs field, but there's no Higgs delta. Then what's really intriguing is that there's only one thing that you would expect to dominate. This should be the biggest thing because it's suppressed by the fewest powers of M. And that one thing is the thing that you've seen, neutrino masses. You shouldn't see anything else, and you don't see anything else. You only see this. So that's very suggestive that that's probably the right picture of what's going on. There's some physics going on at a very high scale, breaking Lepton number. We don't know what it is. It might be sterile neutrinos. It doesn't have to be sterile neutrinos, but there's probably something up there which need not contribute light degrees of freedom to low energies to do what we see, but which breaks Lepton number, and the neutrinos know about it because the perturbation of their masses is dominated by this first term because there was no mass at all in the standard model sector. So you're not competing with something that's already there in the standard model because you broke Lepton number. So it's a very, very compelling picture that the first thing that you would expect to see as a deviation is exactly the thing you do see as a deviation, and you don't see anything else. There will be other interactions at dimension 6, and there's a whole shitload of them. Once you get to dimension 6, you know, the list has at least, you know, 40, 50, probably 100 operators in it, depending on how you count them. If you count the flavors separately, there's hundreds of operators. So the lesson there would be that probably what you learned from neutrino oscillations is that there is a scale in the problem that's very large, not quite so large as the Planck scale. So we now know of two scales that are large, the Lepton number breaking scale and the Planck scale. And whatever they are, they break Lepton number and they break all of Lepton number, and they would give you neutrino masses like that. So what I still have to show you is how those masses, in more detail, lead you to oscillations and then also the resonant oscillations. And how could you tell, is there a way experimentally to tell the difference between this picture and this picture? Supposing that you had a scenario where there were light particles, like let's say that you had sterile neutrinos where some of those sterile guys here had zero eigenvalues. So you actually really had light degrees of freedom that were appearing in the experiments. And so you couldn't capture it all in terms of this kind of a thing. Is there a way to distinguish them? And there is, because in that scenario, you can assign Lepton number to these sterile neutrinos in such a way that the mass term that you get doesn't break the total Lepton number. The experiments so far only show you that these things are broken. So these are seen to be broken. And this is being inferred to be broken if these assumptions are true. But there's no direct experimental information that that's been broken. If that's not broken, then this cannot appear because it's forbidden by that symmetry Lepton number. And so this is not the description of what's going on. There has to, in that case, be something. In that case, these assumptions would be inconsistent with neutrino masses. So that means that there's something else going on. And so the most simple thing to be going on would be that one of these sterile neutrinos or something like it is light, and it's playing a role in these neutrino experiments that you're seeing. So an important experimental issue is, can you distinguish whether this is broken in addition to this? So there's an important class of experiments. Let me do that before lunch. This afternoon, I'm going to stop a little bit early because I'm doing the CFP lecture at Waterloo, and so I want to get over there in time. So you guys that are going elsewhere, if you see Werner or the conversation at Western, you'll be able to get away earlier. I'm thinking of ending at 4:45 or something like that. Perfect. Okay. So this morning, the last thing I want to say here is what can you say about this experimentally about whether a total L is broken? Now let me. The question is, how can you tell if L is broken? L total broken. L with no subscript means the total L.
By total L, do you mean LE plus L minus L tau, or that plus all the other sterile neutrinos?
I mean, this sterile neutrinos, you can't see them, you can't tell if they have other things. There may be other charges that they carry which are broken or not broken, but until we see them, we can't test that.
So is that the reason why they would be broken, because they go into other tests and listen to the sterile neutrinos?
Is that the reason why what?
What the reason why L total would be broken? Because these types of this lepton goes into sterile neutrinos as well, or?
No, what's happening, see, the way that lepton number would be conserved would be that if you constrain this mass matrix to be such that it only links things of positive lepton number to things with negative lepton number, then that matrix, the mass matrix, if you ask why is electric charge not broken by the quark masses, it's because whenever you had if I wrote the quark masses in the same way as I wrote these ones, with left-handed field, it would be, it has the form of, if you broke it up into say, charge two-thirds, charge minus one-third, you know, charge minus one, and so on, the matrix is so here we have. But if I wrote the quarks, let me take the quarks as an example. So we'd have charge two-thirds for the quarks, we have charge minus two-thirds for the, I'm writing left-handed fields, right? So I have left-handed quarks and I have left-handed eddy quarks. In this case, it's the up type ones, and then we have down type ones, we have minus one-third for the up, for the quarks, and then we have plus one-third for the up type, the down type eddy quarks. And then we have the same labels over here, so we have two-thirds, minus two-thirds, minus one-third. Electric charge conservation says that whenever, to have a non-zero, if I draw, this is a block, and then block form, the only way you can get a non-zero entry in this matrix is when I tie a two-thirds with a minus two-thirds. So I can have something non-zero here, I have something non-zero here, I have something non-zero here, and here, but all these other entries are zero. Because then the rotation of this field here is canceling the rotation of this field here. And see, they had opposite charges, so that's consistent with what I told you over here, that if I rotate them the same way with an axis symmetry, then new bar and new bar are rotating the same way. And so that's not invariant. But if this field, if I had field one, field bar, field two, if these fields themselves transform oppositely, then the Gamma 5 would make them, so, you know, so if I have Psi 1 goes to e to the I theta gamma 5 psi 1, psi 2 goes to e to the minus I theta gamma 5 psi 2, and psi 1 bar psi 2 gamma left is invariant because the psi 1 bar, the bar changes the sign, but then the gamma 5 changes it again, so that now these things just multiply each other and then they cancel because of the explicit sum that's there. So the thing is that to have lepton number not be broken, what you have to do in this case is to assign lepton number minus one to a bunch of these sterile guys, and then the only thing that's allowed to be non, so these guys would have to be zero. The ones that mix the things that carry lepton number in the sterile sector would have to be zero. But the ones that mix between the ordinary and the other neutrinos would be non-zero. That would be the only way you could have it survive. And so anything else, the generic case where these guys are all non-zero, you can assign all you want the lepton number to the sterile guys, and you can arrange for the Yukawa coupling to be invariant, but then this mass term is going to break it explicitly in the sterile sector. So there's no assignments you can make which make both the sterile masses and the Yukawa couplings invariant. And that's how you're breaking it in that case. The hard thing is actually to not break it in this situation. But it can be done if you restrict the kinds of couplings you have by the requirement that you make a bunch of zeros whenever you try and relate things to different Another way this question is often asked is the neutrino Majorana or Dirac? Majorana or Dirac particle. What this means is it's like asking if you had a scalar, a spinless particle, is it real or complex? You're asking, is it distinguishable from its antiparticle? Is nu distinguishable from nu bar? And certainly, if the lepton number is not broken, then they're distinguishable because they differ by their electron charge. Antiparticles always have the opposite charge as the particles do. So if they carry any charge at all, then they're distinguishable because the charge distinguishes them. So if so one way you could tell if lepton number is broken, then it's like the mesons we talked about, the kaons and the B mesons. There's no conserved charge in the problem which distinguishes the particle from the antiparticle, so there's nothing which stops it from mixing with each other. And so the particle and the antiparticle then are not the real propagation eigenstates are going to not necessarily be the particle or the antiparticle the way you thought of them when you started with flavor eigenstates like we did up there. So these questions are essentially the same question. The physical issue is there a charge that could distinguish the particle from the antiparticle? And although people typically ask the question this way, what the physics question they're really asking is this one. Because what they mean is this, and this is the answer. So so another way to say that is, you know, if you have given a bunch of left-handed neutrinos, given massless, so what I'm doing here is an aside on spin and a half kinematics to make that connection more explicit. So given the neutrinos we know about, so they're left-handed massless, unless they're left-handed massless states, then the particle states would be labeled by the momentum and by their helicity. Where helicity is, let's say, the momentum dot the spin divided by the absolute value of the momentum. So it's the momentum, the spin in the direction of motion is the quantum number that's a good quantum number for massless states. But CPT on those states takes you to momentum doesn't change sign because momentum is like velocity, right? So that if you take x to minus x under p, charge conjugation doesn't care about momentum. Parity takes x to minus x, so p wants to change sign under parity. But time reversal takes p to minus t, so the fact that you've got a velocity means that there's a sign change for time reversal at all, so p doesn't change. But spin does change because spin is like r cross p, if you like. It's if you're no, it's actually going to lie to you here. So J is R cross P. So say J 3. Well, so what that says is that so spin does change, and so velocity also changes. Yeah, right. So P didn't change, R does change, so J does change, so spin does change. So P didn't change, and sigma changes, so H changes. So for massless particles, the states are distinguishable from the antiparticles because the velocity distinguishes them. So these are the antiparticles, right? The CPT transformation of the particles. These are the antinomies. So that's the way it works in the standard model. But if we now allow neutrino masses, how does the thing change? For massive neutrinos, the states are labeled by momentum and sigma, let's say we're in J3 on P sigma, sigma, P sigma. So this is an this is a component of J. Right? So if we did CPT now on a state with a given spin, we're going to get the momentum. But now J changed signs, right? So that was minus sigma. But this is not necessarily a different particle, right? Because sigma was plus or minus 1/2, essentially. So we already knew that we had both sides of sigma when we had the particle. So CPT by itself doesn't have to give you a new particle. It would be giving you just the opposite spin of the particle you started off with. So if CPT of P plus 1/2 is the same as P minus 1/2, then the particle, the antiparticle, are indistinguishable. And that's what you mean by a Majorana particle. But if there's something which distinguishes them, if the lepton number of these states, say, P sigma is not zero, let's say it's equal to L, or actually in the case of neutrinos, we know it's equal to plus P sigma, then the CPT of P sigma is different. And P minus sigma. That's called the case of a Dirac particle. So that's why these are the same question. That's why the issue is really whether or not there's something like lepton number that distinguishes them. So it's 25 after. The first thing I'll do next time is how would you tell the difference? So how can you distinguish these cases? There is an experimental way to tell. The existing experiments have not told you yet, but there are experiments being done that are looking to see whether or not lepton number is conserved. And they also are a phrase as whether or not the electrons, the neutrinos are Majorana or not, is the way they often phrase what the experiments are doing. This one. I'll pick it up there. Unless there's a question?